Hi. Someone asked about how do you inventory a fantasy? A fantasy is just a story we tell ourselves that is representative of our internal needs and processes. Actually, a fantasy in the real world, it's just like analyzing a dream. Once we, you can actually analyze, there's no difference between analyzing or inventorying a fantasy, a dream, or even a story. You know, you may have had taken a class where people had you analyze a story, right? Like Mark Twain or Charles Dickens or Hamlet. Hamlet's a really good example because Hamlet is all about loss and depression. And how to talk about a book that's about love avoidance. That's all about love avoidance. He sort of has a crush on his mother, and he loses his dad, and who is killed by his uncle, and then his mother falls in love with his, marries his uncle before the funeral's barely over. And so then he, dealing with his grief and his sorrow, he breaks up with Ophelia. She's so hurt by his abandonment, she ends up killing herself. It's understanding a fantasy is just like understanding a play or a movie or a television show. It's a representation of internal processes that everybody has. That's why, like, when Freud came up with the ideas about understanding developmental stages, he used mythology because they represented the basic developmental needs of people. You know, the Oedipal phase and the all the different ones. He described them that way because these were stories that have been told for, you know, millennia. Understanding a personal fantasy is exactly the same. As you start inventorying it, you're looking for the themes. Like, say someone is always having a fantasy about someone who's unavailable. Instead of fighting that, what does that mean? We pick the best connection that we can find that we can tolerate. Oftentimes, people who have a fantasy about emotionally unavailable people, that's telling them what they need. They need someone who isn't really there. Their fear then is of proximity. Or maybe they had a lot of abandonment. If you're never really with anybody, well, then the best thing to do is to have a fantasy where you feel connected to someone who's never going to be available, because if they are unavailable, they can never abandon you. They can never reject you. They don't even know who you are. So once we understand, instead of trying to force ourselves to be with available people, which then what happens? People end up picking emotionally unavailable people, even if the person looks available. So instead of it's just trying to be different, which doesn't admit step one, which says we're powerless. We start to inventory our fantasies. Say I like people who are older or smarter, or say I like people who are like this or like that. And then I just start writing it down. What do they all have in common? How do they all make me feel? Instead of fighting the fantasy, I inventory the fantasy to find out what's going on inside of me. It's telling me what I'm comfortable. It's telling me where I was hurt. It's telling me where what I need. We can inventory a fantasy just like we inventory our real patterns and relationships, just like we might inventory a dream. And one of the best ways we can do that is actually through the fantasy of the kind of fiction that we like. What kind of books do you like? What kind of movies do you like? Okay, like I asked somebody and they said, okay, I only like romantic comedies. Okay, what does that mean? Only only feel comfortable with the quote unquote positive side of things. The kind of the there's too much fear of darkness and loss and danger that at this point in time, maybe they can't even connect with the whole range of emotions. That they have to keep things out there, they have to keep them light, they have to, in their mind, create the happy ending. And again, I'm not saying that's what's happening. What I'm talking about is that we can use a fantasy, just like we use every other inventory, to connect with ourselves, to see patterns in ourselves, to surrender those things to God so He can change them. I don't believe we should fight a fantasy any more than we fight our addiction. We inventory our addiction and we let God show us what it means and how to get free. Do the exact same thing with a fantasy, and then we read it to somebody, we ask God to show us what's next. What's going to happen is over time our fantasies are going to change. Because the needs inside ourselves, the things we hide from, the connections we have, those will actually start to change inside of us. I don't ever suggest people fighting fantasies. I just surrender them to the same inventory, a mission, amends, and prayer process that we do any other aspect of our life. Because in a lot of ways, fantasies are a true reflection of who we are than our quote-unquote social self that we call in reality. Anyway, with that, I pass. Or does someone want to come in on that or have a question?
Yes, I have a question. I'll remain anonymous. I have a question. So I started trying to do that. And what I did, because I don't know how to do it and never occurred to me, is I started writing the fantasy. And it's becoming a book. I am enjoying writing the fantasy more than I enjoy the fantasy itself. So I'm going into the details of how this unavailable person is actually liking me and you know, giving me all the things that I think I want. And like, even though there are the differences in the fantasy, like geographical the unavailability, differences in ages that I can think of from this person that I know in real life that I'm fantasizing about. So instead of writing a whole book of my fantasy, how can I sort of bring it clear so that when I read it to someone, it's not a, you know, how many hours do you have for me to tell you the fantasy?
Well, first of all, one thing is I would just do the exact same thing that we do with a 10 step. So this person, believe it or not, say, okay, what do you, because this is the value of it. In a fantasy, what people don't realize, in a fantasy relationship, we're both characters. We're both the person we're attracted to and the person attracted. Everybody in the fantasy is a reflection of us. So say you say, okay, let's pick the character. We could call him, I don't know, Fred. What does he resent? What are his resentments? What are his fears? What does he want out of life? What is his worldview? You can inventory him. But since you're inventorying him, you're also inventorying you. You're basically, because a fantasy is a connection with the unconscious, you're basically inventorying your unconscious. You can access it in a way you couldn't before. And then see what comes up for that. You can just read that. You can write a little 10-minute inventory on that person. You can read it to somebody. And it's just like when we do an inventory about our conscious emotions, God starts to show us stuff. And then you can do an inventory on the character that we usually see as ourselves. Just, okay, what do I want? What are my resentments? What are my fears? Let's call the female character, because usually there's like a protagonist, right? Female and male protagonist. And then there could be an antagonist. See, and then you can inventory and resent the antagonist, meaning the villain. Because the villain is going to represent usually our abuser that we have organized ourselves around. Is this helpful? Am I going in a helpful direction?
Yeah, question. So this man that I have in mind, so I inventory him, like what are his fears? I have no idea. I'm fantasizing over an image. So, but in me sort of coming up with what I think he wants and fears, mm-hmm. then I am talking to my subconscious that way, in inventing.
Exactly. Because the truth is, you don't know who he is. But you are, the reason he's a focus of your fantasy, there's something in him that you connect to. By inventorying the character, you are connecting to yourself. I don't know, you know, if you want, we could do it now and then we could just take it out of the recording. If it's too intimate.
We can do it. Yeah, I would love to. I've had this fantasy since I remember. So the character changes, but it's the same character. So, yes.
Okay. You want to go just write out, like if, think about the character. Because, see, the character is you. Is write down three resentments, three fears, three things that drive that. You know, what does that character want? And then...
So three resentments he has?
Yeah. I mean, doesn't your character get mad?
Oh, yes.
So three things that he gets mad about, three things that he's afraid of, three things he wants. This is such a great example. I'm going to put the phone down while you write that. Okay, I'll be back.
Okay. He's afraid of... others, in a sense, confrontation. In a sense, things, that he wanted. I got it. Wow. This is to do it this fast is so difficult.
Hi, this is Jane. Sorry about that. It's getting a little warm here. I had to drink some water. Okay, you ready?
Yeah, I got it. Amazingly, I got it quick. So this person is afraid of confrontation, is afraid of relationships getting really close, and is afraid of being honest, like the opposite of me, like spilling the beans of what's happening to him. He can't do that.
Okay.
That's the fears. His resentments are personal anorexia, inability to be with a woman. His resentments is hearing people judge one another, and confrontation, hates confrontation. And
okay, great. That's really great. Okay, keep going. Do the three...
One he wants integrity, he wants love, and he wants to hear, almost in a way of prying, but not really, like he loves hearing other people be vulnerable and speak up their spill their guts, is how I say it. I don't know, that kind of thing.
Okay, tell me what strikes you about that list.
The love part is something I definitely relate to. I want that too. Other than the spilling the guts, me having absolutely no problem, as I'm demonstrating right now, and him not being able to, it seems like I resent the same things and fear the same things, and want the same things. Well, I also want to hear people be vulnerable because I learn from it, but I don't have a fear of doing that. Other than that, it pretty much sounds like me.
It has to sound like you. And does it sound like anybody else in your family, or does it sound more like you?
Probably my mom. Yeah, probably my mother. Sounds like my mother.
And you sound like you have some emotion in your voice when you say that.
that just touched it, yeah.
Then I would keep, then do it, you know, you're always, okay, wake up and do it again tomorrow. And then do the other character. And then is there a villain in your story?
Oh, no, this is just him and me. And we walk through canals and everything is lovely. And it's just adorable. And things go according to the dating plan. And the sponsor agrees. And it's all beautiful. There's never a hitch. Like the only difficult conversations are somehow going to be solved. Like geographical unavailability, for example. The fantasy is riding into the horizon, Cinderella style, up until the ball, and then we don't know anything anymore. Up until the happy ending, and we don't hear anymore.
That, and then you could, you know, like there's the fourth one, the lies we believe, or is that with the right person, everything's going to go great, all problems, or the fear that all problems will be solved. Well, one of the problems of that not being true is, and there's, as long as there are problems, they protect us. Having everything go well, it's scary for a love avoidant, right? Because then there's nothing to stop it. That, or maybe in your mind, it's like, okay, I can't go beyond that. You know, what? I don't know what to do. I meet somebody, there's an attraction. Maybe I meet a need of theirs. They're maybe a little more withdrawn. I'm more open. They can't connect with themselves. I help them connect. We solve all these problems. But after that, I don't know what to do.
Right.
And that's the fantasy is you just, it, what it tells you about yourself is you lead, that's the kind of person you want, that's the way you offer yourself. But once the attraction happens, there's a part of you that's afraid, you don't know what to do after that. What do you think about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's connecting you with the fear of having it work out, because that, just to even say, maybe I don't know what to do after the attraction. How do I have a real relationship? How do I do day to day? I don't think I'm gonna do that well.
Yeah.
Are you relating to that at all?
Yeah, which is also probably what happened to my mother, and which is the model I grew up by, and is what I did in every relationship. It's beautiful in the beginning, and then I don't know how to do it, or I mess it up, or, yeah.
So that then it gives us a direction to go. So this is then, what does a love addict, love avoidant do? They pick somebody that's going to create enough conflict and chaos that they never really get to the part where they don't know what to do. They know how to deal with chaos, so they're just going to do that. They'll pick someone that's going to protect them from the part they don't know how to do. And that,
so
then what that
who,
does...
Sorry. Huh? So someone who will also not know what to do after the honeymoon to protect.
Well, there you go then too. Yeah, it's like, then as long as you pick someone that's going to create problems, you don't have to ever get past that, because you don't even know what's past that. And that helps you identify the conflict and the need, which is, it's not so much that I need to learn how to pick somebody else. It's, I more need to look at my fears of what happens after and learn how to apply spiritual principles to calm. Which, in fact, you are doing by being part of the service committee, right? Nobody creates problems. We all try to solve problems. And as we, that there's a pain to that and a discomfort to that, and yet that's how we get comfortable with applying spiritual principles to what happens after the ball, you know? What happens after the great romance connection. Unknowingly, we pick people who are going to protect us from that part of it because we don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that? I'm just going by the story you gave me.
Yeah, no, I like it. I think I will inventory again tomorrow what you said, probably about the fantasy, and compare it to my mother. I'm not sure about that. And I guess in keep on inventorying this and reading it, which is the principle of the program, I'll get to some, God will help me with insights, I mean, I suppose.
Well, and then I would just keep, like, say, okay, there's that. And then I would do the female character, inventory the female character, just share it. Because that's the thing is, inventories are, we can never see past the first 10 steps. Mm. I mean, do you see some stuff maybe you didn't see before?
Let's see. You mean in the fantasy?
I mean, just like what we did today. Do you maybe see some things you didn't see before?
Yes. I had not seen my mother, and I had not seen that this character is me that I'm fantasizing about most 90%.
Well, it has to be you. It's your fantasy. It has to be you. this is what people have to understand. Even if someone is a fantasy addict, the person they're connecting with is themselves. And the basic need of any fantasy addict is self-connection. As they inventory the fantasy, just like that, they see which part of themselves they need to connect with, or which early relationships were unsatisfying, or like so you did it today, you saw a little bit, and then you wake up tomorrow and you write, you say, okay, well, let's do this one. And then you read that to somebody, 10-minute inventory, 8-minute phone message leaving, and then you're going to see something else. You get up tomorrow and do it the next day. It's your unconscious is trying to communicate to you. And this is how you kind of transcribe or translate what it's trying to tell you, is through that little daily tip step. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I actually just saw something very clear in what you said there. If it's me, then now I see how I'm projecting in the fantasy how I need to protect me from whatever happened with my mother. And so in the fantasy, I'm sort of like still building the same story of protection. I'm still super afraid. Yeah, I this may not make sound to you sense, but for me, it's like a thundering revelation.
No, of course it makes sense to me.
It's a protection of, it's a mechanism of, I can't even speak, it's a mechanism of protection for me, this fantasy. I'm safe. I'm safe. I'm with me, and we're still protecting from mommy and all that. Wow. I'll keep inventory me tomorrow. Yes. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. You made it. Well, you know, until people ask, I don't know how to fill in the part. So you can decide if you want that shared, or we could just transcribe it without your name. But that,
I think I would like this one. I didn't put any specifics. So, and I really think that the examples is what bring the point home. It just did it for me. It's getting specific that does it. And I know that as I continue inventorying, there's going to be more light to it.
Well, it's why a lot of times people think that journaling is going to give them the same effect that an inventory does. And like when you write a narrative, it's not that what you're saying isn't true. And it's not that it doesn't reflect things. But for some reason, which I don't know, I didn't write the book, those four words, those will somehow connect things in a way that opened the door for God to show me things I couldn't see before. So at any point in your narrative, you can stop and say, okay, what is the character angry about? What is the character afraid of? What does the character want? And as you honestly answer that question, you are in fact inventorying your unconscious fears and hurts. You are inviting God to come in and let you use your unconscious to communicate what it so desperately wants to. If it didn't want to communicate, it wouldn't keep giving you the fantasy, It's just like a recurring dream. A recurring dream means there's something your unconscious is trying to tell you, right? A fantasy is just a recurring dream you have when you're awake. And you can analyze it and subject it to those four, that inventory, just exactly the way you could a dream. It's not any different. Does that at least give it a direction?
Yeah, wow.
This is what, when people talk about a fantasy addiction, they act like somehow, this is the truth. No, everybody lives in a fantasy, all right? Everybody's perception of themselves is a fantasy. Everybody's perception of actual people they know is a fantasy. They don't really know those people. They're seeing the projection of their needs and their interpretation. Now, do real people exist? Does real life exist? Sure it does. But people's perception of that is in fact a fantasy. It's why the rules for inventorying, admitting, and amending are not any different for a fantasy than they are for quote-unquote reality. Because most people's reality is a fantasy anyway.
Wow. So, wow. Yes. Yeah, nothing is real. It's just what I make it with my mind.
It may be real, but you don't know what it is.
Right, it's what I perceive, what I think it is. Everything is a fantasy. I don't really know a person. It's true. And intimacy is a hard road because it would mean to actually begin to see the reality of someone, to open up to get out of the fantasy and listen and begin to get to know some. That's super scary stuff.
Well, and I know, see, now it's like, see, that like all you do is talk about a fantasy, but it's actually, then you get to see, and I'll add, this is the important thing. The fantasy is self-protective. Once you inventory one layer of the fantasy, you start to see the reality that it's protecting you from. And then the fear comes, oh, man. It's why people think a lot of times when they go to pick a partner, they go, I'll pick somebody different this time. I'm like, because I'm sober now, I'm like, well, how much step work have you done on why you pick the people you pick? None. Do you know how to apply your 10-step when you meet somebody in the fantasy uploads? Nope. Then why would it be any different? The needs that we connected with the people we connected with before still exist. Until we inventory and admit the needs that drove us to connect in the ways we did before, we are going to make the exact same choices. That's where all the action comes between inventorying the people God puts in front of us.
Especially in romantic relationships, especially. I mean, otherwise we're going to keep projecting the same fantasy without ever observing it and facing the fear.
Well, I'm going to take it as it's like inventory. That's why it's so important to inventory everybody God puts in front of us. Because romance, it's like, it's kind of like trying to think clearly when you're drunk. If we practice, what will happen is we will project those same needs. We will have those same reactions on all the people around us. But we get to, so we get to inventory, admit, and see, and make amends, but we're in a more clear state. If we wait to learn how to do this when we're attracted to somebody, we've just lost our opportunity for any kind of emotional objectivity. It's like, I'm always talking about that, right? Who annoys you today? I go, you know, don't pick your husband or your father, or your boyfriend, whatever. Pick the person at the drive-thru. Pick who annoyed you in the last 20 minutes, right? Because then you have a better chance of connecting clearly with yourself. If we wait to do it when we're attracted, we have just taken our chances of honesty and objectivity and obliterated them. Desire warps perception. So just, that's why you should practice on the fantasies God puts in front of us where we don't really care. Or practice on the fantasies of the book that we like. Or practice on the fantasies of a TV show we like. Because we don't, it's an opportunity to learn how to connect with ourselves using the spiritual principles of the steps without having the huge emotional investment and intoxication of a romantic partner. What do you think about that?
Yeah, totally. I mean, talk about getting sober, but then not being ready to sit in front of heroin. Of course.
Yeah,
of course. I mean, if this isn't practiced and as a honed skill, I mean, God may send me the right man and I'll just have no chance. The addiction will take over if I'm not able to see the projections that I put into this person and fantasies that will start covering up the fear, which will lead to the same problems, I would say. Maybe not disasters because I have a lot of tools now, but sort of problems that could perhaps be better confronted if I'm more prepared through inventories and using the principles of the program, my sponsor, people, sharing, etc.
And I really want to appreciate, I can't tell you, I don't know if you're willing to have this transcribed or whatever, but this is the, you know, what we're talking about right now, it's probably the major cause of relapse in long-term sober people. Because they don't know how to apply the principles of the inventory, admission, amends, service to whoever is in front of them, and they get cut off from themselves. And then when they're presented with their drug, what happens is then the reason we have a fantasy is to connect with ourselves. The reason we have that relationship is to connect. Somehow that connection gives us something we can't get any other way. If we, as we practice those, that inventory, admission, amends, and service, God will send us the right sponsee, the right sponsor, the right person to annoy us in a meeting, as you know. And as we work that through, it's then when we go to that time of sobriety to a relationship 6 years later, we're not disconnected. We're constantly inventorying, admitting, amending, praying, the connections that God puts in front of us. So we're not living in an emotional desert. We're living in a constant state of opportunities to connect to ourselves, others, and God. It's what breaks. It's otherwise people are too vulnerable. They get lonely in their anorexia, and then they just reach out for their drug again.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it also, maybe not for this conversation, but it makes me wonder if the dating plan needs to be inventory too. So for example, when in my dating plan was long distances and no. And when I met someone where there is a somewhat of a possibility, I think, I don't know, the long distance was a resound no, not even a possibility of a conversation, I mean, I don't know, but I wonder if that can also be observed or inventory or rather than having a yes or no view, which is more of an addict response. But this is very helpful.
I'm going to go with absolutely. Because, right. See, this is what's going to happen. Anything we do with act of will alone will be less than useless against our addiction. What we need is a way to apply principles to every aspect of our addiction, because that could serve your love avoidance too. Mm-hmm. It's a way to protect you from 99.9% of the population. There could be the most perfect guy in the world from Arizona, but nope, he's too far away. Instead of, okay, God, what limitations do you want me to have? The addiction, any decision we make by self-will alone, the addiction's going to make it. The addiction's going to make it. Both our love addiction, our sex addiction, our love avoidance. Any decision we surrender to the steps, traditions, and the concepts, that means we're giving God a chance to make the decision. And again, this is like a really important point that for some reason, people don't know that's what those traditions and concepts and steps are for. It's to invite God into all our interactions with other people. What do you think about that?
Yeah, now it just leaves me confused, as if I rejected this guy immediately because of my own will, and if I should go back, which is also my own will, so it's probably something to be inventoried as well, like never a rush decision, but it does leave me wondering now, did I rush there and do my own thing without asking God? And I absolutely did. And I get the sort of like the idea now of keep inventorying, keep sharing. I still have his phone number. I don't know what God's going to say.
Well, how about this? This is why we do it, is write the inventory, just see what happens. Because this is the truth. When we're addicts, all of our impulses are suspect. Our impulse to connect is obviously suspect. Our impulse to disconnect is suspect. Our impulse to wait is suspect. Our impulse to do something right away, all of our impulses are suspect. Mm-hmm. Anything unsurrendered to these principles, that's the disease, right? Because I'm made of it. This is a trauma-based addiction. All of my reactions grow out of that traumatic history. And then my shot for every decision I make, particularly, I don't know, and not just if it has to do with dating or sex or love, any reaction I have I have to inventory it. That's how I surrender it to God. If I haven't inventoried, I'm just going to say that. If I haven't inventoried it and admitted it to someone, I have not given God a chance to tell me what he wants. That's the way he set it up, right? Mm-hmm. I hear people say, well, I'm just going to turn it over to God. I go, well, how did you do that? Well, I just did it in my mind. I'm like, okay, well, let me know how that goes. Mm-hmm. We all know how it goes, all right? We can't even turn things over by act of will alone. The only thing that's really going to work is to surrender it to the process of the steps, traditions, and concepts, and then see what's left over. That's the only part. Am I annoying you, or is this helpful?
No. I see. I mean, every one of my tendencies to act fast is an instinct gone astray due to trauma, and there is no just turning over like, oh, let me turn it over and it's turned over. It means, I mean, we become inventory machines. That's what we do.
We have to. But this is the thing that surprises me. Everyone thinks it's really strange in Chile, you know. Like I said, I go to open AA meetings. Everybody does them every day. Everybody does it if the decision comes up. I mean, that's the part that kind of blows me away. Is in AA, the open AA meetings I go to, right in the 10th step, it's just business as usual. You know, working a step on any difficult decision is just business as usual. In Chile, you know, I'm like an oddity. It's like people say, well, that's weird. Why would you write an inventory on that? I'm like, 12 steps. Seems like a good idea. But like I said, I go to, I go, okay, wait, am I, everyone thinks this is so weird. Am I off? And then, like I said, this one open AA meeting I go to, everybody does it. Everybody does it. I know. It's just so, like, okay, I am. I'm there. Like Bill Wilson, he talks about it too. Because our job now is to be fitted to maximum usefulness to God and to our fellows. We're just constantly, when we're disturbed, we have a spiritual response to any emotional disturbance. I'm like, okay. But for some reason, in an addiction that's about emotions and relationships, people think they can do it without that, which I don't understand at all. But hey, maybe that'll at least kind of scoot people in considering it from what you shared.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Jane.
Well, thank you for your question. Does anybody else want to come in on fantasies or working your steps on fantasies? Well, we've been going.
I'm going to stop the recording now, okay?
Okay.
Thank you, Scott.